The Guardian.
Hello everybody, this is Guardian Football Weekly Extra. World Cup qualification is complete. Today we'll work out the ultimate group of death. Congratulations to Sweden, Denmark, Australia and Peru. Bad luck to Ireland, Honduras, Italy and defeated New Zealand. Plus the Premier League is back, we'll look ahead to that. Ryan Babbel Watch, your questions, feedback corner, and that's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Italy will not be at the World Cup. Here to be sad about it, Paolo Bandini. Out of 10, how sad are you?
10.
10. Ireland will not be at the World Cup. Here to be sad about it, Barry Glendening. Out of 10, how sad are you?
6.
Okay. West Ham will not be at the World Cup. Here to be sad about it, Jacob Steinberg. Out of 10, how much are you bouncing off the walls about David Moyes?
6.
6. Okay. We'll get on to that in a bit. We now know all the 32 teams who'll compete in Russia. Should we begin with the Ireland inquest and then do the Italy inquest next? Barry, you're an Irishman. After the first leg, I think you sent a tweet saying, look, both these sides are equally rubbish, so it might as well be us who go to the World Cup. Have you rethought that?
Yeah, I don't think Denmark are rubbish. They were. I think Ireland dragged them down to our level in the first leg. In the second leg, we didn't do that. Ireland's players look leggy and tired. They look cranky with each other. There were some very bad individual errors compounded by what you wouldn't describe as a tactical masterclass from Martin O'Neill. I think his decision to take off both holding midfielders at half-time has been, you know, roundly traduced in Irish football circles, and, you know, it was a mistake that gave Christian Eriksen far too much room to operate in, and he, being one of the best players in the world, rose to the occasion when his country needed him and took full advantage of all the acres of space he was offered. It's easy to say these things with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, but I think Martin O'Neill made a grievous error, and I even thought it was a terrible mistake at the time, by taking off David Myler and Harry Arter at half-time. I think that was a rash decision. Ireland needed 2 goals at the time. If they'd got one, you know, the crowd would have been, they would have had momentum. I don't think there was any need to do that so early. I think taking off Harry Arter would have been a good idea, replacing him with Wes Hoolihan, who perhaps isn't, and I know producer Mel will disagree with this, but isn't as great as possibly.
There's a weird obsession with Wes Hoolihan being the greatest footballer on earth when he's not picked for Ireland.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's the greatest footballer we have on his day, but, you know, he was brought on, and then there was aimless long balls lumped towards him for the entirety of the second half. You know, Wes, for all his magnificent attributes, he's 5'6". You know, he's not going to win those balls. I think Harry Arter playing for Ireland in the last few games has looked a shadow of the player that plays for Bournemouth. You know, at Bournemouth, he gets on the ball, he dictates the tempo, he dictates the play. With Ireland, any time the ball comes near him, he hoofs it as far up the field as he possibly can. I'm not sure why, if it's managerial instruction. I assumed it was managerial instruction, but there was one point he did it and Roy Keane jumped out of his seat in the dugout and gave him a roasting, you know, for treating the ball like a live grenade. So there's bad decisions and just a poor overall performance. And, you know, you might as well lose 5-1 as 3-1, but Ireland could have absolutely no complaints about not going to the World Cup because they were absolutely thrashed, and their misfortune was entirely of their own making.
Is that pain better than the Northern Ireland pain?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not particularly upset about it. It would be nice to be there, but I'm over it, you know. Ireland aren't a good team to watch. I think if I wasn't Irish, I'd much prefer to see Christian Eriksen play at the World Cup, you know, but these things happen.
Jacob or Paolo, either of you want to defend Martin O'Neill?
Well, tactically, I mean, I didn't see the game as doing the England game, but from as far as Barry said, and what you don't have to go too far in the Irish sports media to see how much criticism he received for those 2 substitutions. I don't know whether he might have maybe considered moving David Myler to right back, because apparently Cyrus Christie had something of a shocker at right back, and maybe yes, keeping that player on the pitch. But then there's also now a lot of talk here and there about whether Martin O'Neill will stay on. I know that before the Moldova game, there was kind of a talk between a verbal agreement between him and John Delaney. So whether or not they go back on that now and think that he hasn't achieved the aim of getting through, we'll have to wait and see. It's interesting about whether O'Neill is a man out of his time a little bit. There's a lot of talk about him perhaps not planning enough before these games. It's fairly well out there. I think Shay Given in an interview's kind of spoken about O'Neill doesn't give a lot of instruction or directions to the players. A lot of it is left for them to sort it out themselves.
So what does he do? He's just like, come on, lads, you can do it.
You look at this, the Ireland team, and they've made a big thing about the fighting quality. David Myler before the game on Monday, saying we're going to win because Denmark don't have the same fighting spirit that we have. But then if they have the same, one of the things being said, if they don't have more than the fighting spirit, then do you not need someone else who's going to come in and tactically organise this team beyond O'Neill's apparent rousing motivational oratory before in the dressing room in the build-up to these big games? Because Ireland have been pretty good in these big games up until now when it's all on the line, but how far you can sustain that when you keep coming up against better sides and it's you have to win these games. They kept doing it against Italy, against Germany. They did it against Wales. Games everyone thought they were going to lose, and finally, it's come crashing down. And perhaps it shows the lack of a plan.
The one thing I would say, Martin O'Neill was interviewed after the game by this guy from RTE, a fellow called Tony O'Donoghue, and they kind of have a fractious relationship down the years, but. Tony sort of described the game, would you say it was a humiliation, Martin, and you could see O'Neill getting angrier and angrier, and he cited, the Germany game where we beat them with that Shane Long goal a couple of years ago as an example of, good thing he's done. But I think that game, well, people tend to forget the result on paper, Ireland won 1-0. They were so lucky to win that. They were slaughtered and still won 1-0.
Do you think Shane Long will ever score again?
I'm beginning to wonder, actually.
Good chance, didn't he? And
who'll score first, him or Saido Berahino?
Oh, that's a very good question. Paolo, as Barry said, the thing to come out of this game that we should all celebrate is that Christian Eriksen is a brilliant footballer, probably still pretty underrated, and just showed what class he has.
Yeah, I can't speak to whether he's underrated. I certainly think he's an extraordinary player. I think, first of all, just what a hat trick in terms of goal by goal, what fantastic strikes. But I think he's added something more and more under Pochettino at Tottenham. I think he's definitely a more physically robust player than he was, and that's sort of notable that he's added more muscle, a little bit more strength. Not that he necessarily needed it here, but I think that's part of what's making him such an extraordinary player. I think he's someone who contributes more than he's always necessarily noticed for. He's one of those players you don't necessarily perceive as a lunatic charging about, but actually is always involved, always getting himself in the places that he needs to be. I think he's a really present player for Tottenham, and I think he's obviously the most important player on this Denmark team.
I think it's taken a while to get it going, because if you go back to 2013 and a little bit before that, everybody knew who Christian Eriksen was, that he was the best Danish player and he was tearing up for Ajax, and I think Dortmund were looking at him as the replacement for Götze when he was heading off to Bayern Munich, and then they were one of the best teams in Europe at the time, less so now, and they decided not to go for him. Tottenham at that time went for him instead, and they obviously weren't quite at the level that they are now. I'm not sure that they would have got a better Christian Eriksen at that time, and he had a little bit of a habit of disappearing at times, certainly the first half of last season. I think a lot of Tottenham fans were wondering if they were going to see the real Christian Eriksen, when Harry Kane was out and Dele Alli had a little bit of a slow start to the season, and they looked at Eriksen, he didn't quite do it. But in the last year or so, he's really taken it up a level. Not just this game, but Real Madrid as well.
We're going on a tangent, but how many Tottenham players can we say that for? And Pochettino is doing such an extraordinary job of just bringing through these players and making them better. Bringing them through is maybe the wrong word for a player like Eriksen, who has already established himself as a very, very bright prospect in Europe, but sort of taking players on, players who are already good players, and making them into something even more.
This is a point you've made before, that players can actually get better and worse as they play, but I won't have it. You're that good, and that's where it stays. Barry, a lot of the Ireland players are old. Is this a chance for something an all new Ireland, or are you destined to be gone forever?
I don't know. I mean, you look at players like Houlihan, probably reached the end of the line now. Aidan McGeady. I mean, sorry, that was one other thing. Martin O'Neill's defence of his double substitution at half-time is, you know, I had to do something. And that's fair enough. I don't think he had to do it quite that early. But, yeah, you did have to do something. But if the answer is Aidan McGeady, you know, Aidan McGeady has, I think, nearly 100 or possibly more than 100 caps.
93, isn't it?
93, yeah. Caps for Ireland. I can't remember a single contribution of note he's made in those 93 appearances. And, you know, he was awful in the second half of the game against Denmark. Constantly lost possession, wasn't putting in crosses. And, you know, I just didn't see the logic of bringing him on. But, you know, he's nearing the end now.
O'Shea, Whelan.
Yeah, well, they didn't feature anyway. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not sure who's coming through. You know, so, a lot of players in that team as well, they made dreadful mistakes. Cyrus Christie had a mare. Stephen Ward was, you know, responsible for two goals. He ended up in the heart of defence and, you know, made an awful mistake there that let in Ericsson, so I think for his third. Time for a fresh start, and things could get worse before they get better.
Time for a fresh start for Italy as well, Paolo. How are you feeling, and how are Italians?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is going to last a really long time, the impact of this. In terms of the immediate disappointment, is obviously, I think, the first sort of 24, 48 hours you feel really low about it. And I think people carry on with their lives. But I do think next summer it's going to be actually really hard for a lot of Italians to have the World Cup going on and not be part of it. Because it's, again, I feel like I've said this a lot in recent days. People look at smaller Serie A attendances and they draw conclusions about Italians not being as sort of wild for football as they were before. And that's absolutely very, very far from my experience of people I spend time with in Italy. Every experience, every exchange I have when I go to Italy, which is often, you know, people there still care about football as much as they ever did, even if they're not physically attending the games in Serie A at the same level that they would have in the 90s. And I think that it's going to be a huge sort of blow to the national psyche that this sport, which, you know, Italy is not... Actually, you know, I would say as a nation right now, Italy is not always hugely sort of proud of a lot of the way things have gone in the last sort of, I don't know, a few decades. There's a lot of nostalgia in that country. A lot of people who go, oh, we don't do X, Y, and Z as well as we used to. But football and food are two things that Italians always remain very proud of. And this football team and the last few World Cup cycles, Italy has not been able to sort of play its part in that. And this is 60 years after the last missing out on a World Cup. It's a huge event.
Aventura has been sacked. How much was this his fault?
Hugely. Obviously, the fault goes higher up the chain than that because he was probably a poor choice to be appointed in the first place. Certainly, there should have been stronger intervention sooner. He was just found to be totally out of his depth. He got key decisions wrong about players, his tactics, he shuffled back and forth. He didn't even have the courage of his own convictions, wrong-headed though some of them were. I mean, he talked about 3-5-2 as a formation that was part of the past before. He seems to have gone back to it in part as a result of player pressure, but the fact that the player pressure with us there was indicative of how much he had completely lost control of the changing room. You know, he had players organising meetings without him because they basically felt like he wasn't in control, and he wasn't. His team's lined up in all the different formations. He called up like more than 50 players over the course of the qualifying, or certainly over the course of his tenure, don't know about qualifying specifically. He never at any point gave his team an identity, never at any point gave his team a sense of we are trying to play in a certain way, we're trying to do certain things. And I think it was interesting, the conversation we were just having about Ireland and the sort of, well, what we, you know, can do is out-commit people. Actually, the Italians in the build-up to that second leg against Sweden, the word you heard from players, Gigi Buffon certainly, was rabbia, which is rage. You know, people wanted to, they felt like they were going to have to find this rage to get through the tie. And to an extent, they did in that second leg. I thought particularly the first half, there was rage in that performance from Italy. There were tackles flying in. There was aggression. There was an attempt to turn things around. But there was just no coherence. There was no system. There was no actual plan for how they were going to do it, other than Antonio Candreva doing the worst part of what he's done for Inter in what's otherwise been a bright season, of just hoofing crosses into a box where everyone else is taller than you anyway. So it was really directionless and disappointing.
Yeah, strange game where they could and potentially should have been four penalties.
Yeah.
Do you think?
I think that, I think all four of them.
Two for both sides. So it evens out over a playoff, doesn't it? What happens now then?
Well, Ventura is finally gone, the manager. He had to be pushed, which is its own sort of conversation in Italy. But you know,
did he really say, I've had one of the best records? Lost only two games? I saw that quote, but I...
He said a bunch of things that were, didn't paint him in a great light. I mean, even at the end of those two legs, which I don't think any Italian came away from thinking, oh, we deserve to go through and we this is a great injustice. He was still basically saying, we didn't do anything wrong. This proves there was nothing wrong with this Italy team. And he's a man who has dug his heels in and been stubborn to the last. And I suppose on a human level, I understand you get an €800,000 compensation package if you get fired, whereas if you resign, you don't get it. On the other hand, Cesare Prandelli, who had taken Italy to the final of the Euros and then failed to get through the group at the World Cup, resigned immediately. And I think there's an honour in that, which Ventura hasn't shown. But look, he's gone. A lot of people would like to see Tavecchio, the president of the Football Federation, go as well. He's not going to. He's already said he's staying. He is the man who was sort of infamously, before election, made some comments that have been repeated countless times. They're unpleasant comments about banana eaters in the lower leagues. He is, in my opinion, I think, also should have fallen on his sword. I think a lot of people feel like that. But in the way that these hierarchies are, the people who are immediately around him, don't think so, and so he's going to carry on. Actually, Damiano Tommasi, who is now the head of the Players Association in Italy, walked out of a meeting of the sort of... They have all the heads of the various relevant bodies in Italian football, so the referees, the managers, the players, and the Football Federation, they all had a round table to discuss what to do next. And when it became clear that Tavecchio wasn't going, Tommasi said, I'm out, basically, and left the meeting.
I read somewhere... Was Ventura getting the job in the first place as sort of a jobs for the boys kind of appointment?
It was a money saving appointment more than anything. Conte had been expensive. It was a complicated deal arranged with sponsor support from Puma, and Ventura was a much cheaper option. There was a pragmatism to it, which I understand, which is that actually in modern international football, it's hard to get the best managers to do that job. And Conte had unquestionably, before the Euros, where he fell in love with the atmosphere of the actual tournament, he'd had itchy feet. He was, talking all the time about missing club football and the day-to-day of it. Ventura was 68 and had just done the best part of his career at Torino, where he got them into the Europa League. And so he was someone who you could pick and go, all right, well, he won't go anywhere and he'll, develop young players for us and he's seen enough, but... I think just found out massively in terms of his actual tactical acumen and ability to command a powerful dressing room.
Is this a moment that will make Italy want to tear things up and start again like, Germany in 2000 after they went out in the first round and everything? Or is it a case of looking at the bench and seeing someone like Insigne not come off it and think, actually, we had a perfectly good team and there are young players coming through as well at, Milan and...
Yeah,
Atalanta.
I think it's a really interesting and important question. Certainly the media climate in Italy right now is we need to tear everything up and start again. There's a lot of calls for that. And I think there are some things that Italy really does still need to do. The stadiums is the glaringly obvious one, but also the investment in youth academies. Some teams are doing a great job with it, like Atalanta, and other teams really aren't. And that's something that could still be done a lot better. I am of the opinion that this really was a squad of players that was more than capable of going to the World Cup. And I think that there is a generation already of young Italian talent that is playing in Serie A that shows evidence that there is plenty of promise for the future already. You look at Mattia Caldara at Atalanta, soon to be with Juventus, Daniele Rugani already with Juventus, Gigi Donnarumma starting for Milan, Andrea Conti starting for Milan, Federico Chiesa starting. There's so many good young Italian players now that I don't think we need to go all the way down the tear everything up route. And there's talk about imposing foreigner quotas in the league again, which is something that we haven't seen for a while, or certainly non-EU players, which that stuff feels knee-jerk. I think it's okay to have a discussion about it, but I look at the numbers and certainly Serie A has a smaller percentage than the Premier League, although you could argue that England's performance doesn't make them the best example for that, but I think it's comparable still to the Bundesliga and La Liga, so it's not necessarily...
This is sad news for Davo, who says, when Paolo, like my dad, bangs on about foreign players in Serie A harming the national team, which you just didn't do, ask him how many the Bundesliga have. That's right, Max, you guessed it, basically the same percentage.
Well, so this, I feel like this is one line in a piece that I wrote this week, which was, I was responding to Tavecchio comments saying that he had made these crass racist comments about banana eaters flooding the leagues. And I said there is a valid discussion to be had about the number of foreigners. That doesn't mean that I agree with that side of discussion. I think that you can be not racist and have that conversation. My personal opinion is that's not the issue that Italian football's facing.
I found it extraordinary. Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Roma put a team out to play Chelsea that had not a single Italian in the starting 11?
Yeah, I mean, I can't think off the top of my head, but that sounds entirely plausible. There are players, Italian players at Roma, though, who are fundamental to them. De Rossi is still an important part of that side. Alessandro Florenzi has had a huge injury problems, but hugely important player for them. They've got Italians there.
I'm not saying Roma don't have Italians. It was a real jolt to the system to see an Italian side with no Italians in it.
Sure. I mean, Inter have done that before. You know, I mean, Inter were always reputed as the international team, and so that's, you know, it's in their name, obviously. But they, you know, that is a bit more part of their history. But it happens. And it's happened in England with Arsenal fielding teams with no English players in them. I'm sure others as well. It's modern football. To me, that doesn't necessarily eliminate your ability to have a good national team.
Here we go, says, question for Paolo. Will it be a good time to go on holiday to Italy next summer?
I mean...
It's always a good
time. It's always, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly where I was going to go. It's never a bad time to go on holiday to Italy, in my opinion.
Actually, Italians support?
I don't think it's as simple as one team that all of Italy will get behind. I imagine you'll see a fair amount of club loyalty among teams that have players that, you know, for instance, in Naples, I can imagine a lot of people getting behind Mertens in the same way that actually a lot of Naples sort of got behind Maradona when he was playing for Argentina. So I think there'll be a bit of that, but I don't know, there's not one team for Italy to get behind.
Akshay says, how good is Jorginho? Would he fit at Liverpool? He is a lovely player, isn't he?
Yeah.
And bizarre that Ventura didn't.
Yeah,
that was the first time he played him.
I feel like I waffled on for a long time though, without sort of listing all the specific things Ventura did wrong. That's a glaring one. You know, a player who is absolutely running things for Napoli, who are top of Serie A right now. Very elegant midfielder who, he set a record not long ago for the most touches by a player in a single Serie A game. He's just someone who runs a game from midfield. And I think he could do a job at Liverpool. But for the sake of Italian football, I hope he hangs around at Napoli a little bit longer.
Ollie says, are us Australians going to be the only ones happy to see Italy miss out on the World Cup given the penalty dive incident in 2006? We'll get on to Australia in a sec. Lucas Neal didn't need to go to ground, to be fair. And Mark says, was Italy a victim of...
It was a penalty. I'm sorry to break it again to Australians, but that is a penalty.
It was a penalty.
And Mark says, was Italy a victim of bad karma due to the traitorous actions of certain well-known Italian-centric podcasters? No idea what that means. That will do for part one. In part two, we'll begin with Australia. Welcome back to part two of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Now to the final two teams who made it to Russia. Peru beat New Zealand overnight. First, Australia are through. They beat Honduras 3-1. A Miller Jedinek hat-trick. Here to talk us through it is Australian football writer Kieran Pender. Kieran, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Congratulations and all that. When we spoke to you on Monday, you said Jedinek was very important to the team, and you were absolutely right.
I was, but I didn't expect him to be scoring goals. He scored very few goals for the Socceroos. And as I said when I was last on the show, he's barely played this season for Aston Villa or the national team. So for him to step up big time in the most important game for the Socceroos in a decade was exceptional. And he really, you know, he got the ball rolling with a deflected free kick in the 53rd minute. It had been all the Socceroos in the first half, but they just couldn't break down the Hondurans. And that free kick really opened the floodgates, and then two penalties. One was somewhat line ball call, and the other was a nailed-on penalty, led the Socceroos to a win.
How much of it was because Australia weren't as tired as Honduras because they didn't let the Hondurans fly back on their fancy aeroplane? They made them, you know, go cattle class via LA when the Australians had special specs on and physio tables on their flight.
Well, those specs have certainly got a bit of a laugh, haven't they? Yeah, for the first goal, I don't think it had much to do with it. You know, by that stage, 53 minutes in, both teams are still fairly energetic. And in fact, Australia were actually starting to tire. Tim Cahill, particularly our talisman, was looking quite leggy. But then after that goal and the deflation to Honduras, they then just lost it. And the second penalty, the third penalty, so the second goal, third goal, both penalties, they were really the result of poor defending, probably occasioned by that tiredness. However, FIFA tweeted an interesting stat after the game, that Australia is actually the team that's travelled the, you know, almost possibly the most, 155,000 miles, which is 250,000 kilometres, they've travelled for this campaign, which is pretty astonishing when you think about it. When you think in some of those European countries, probably barely leave their, you know, their area, and Australia have travelled all around the world.
What's going to happen with your manager? Because Ange Postecoglou's, he's taken a lot of flack in this qualifying campaign. We still don't know for sure if he's going to be in charge of the Socceroos when the World Cup starts.
Ange Postecoglou is a bit of an enigma. He's very divisive, particularly so in recent months. So after he successfully guided the Socceroos past Syria in the penultimate stage of qualification, the sudden death continental knockout, the next day a story broke in Australian media saying that he was quitting after the Honduras clash regardless. He has refused to confirm or deny that, and he's been very, you know, non-committal. And again, last night, he was asked about it, obviously, and he said, look, I won't take too long. Right now, I'm just enjoying the moment. So the speculation is he's off, which is odd, because who turns down the chance to manage their country at a World Cup? And he'd be the first... You know, he's the first Australian to have led Australia to a World Cup, and you know, this has been an amazing achievement for him after managing them in the last World Cup, but that wasn't his team. That was a team he came in for, Brazil 2014, but this is his team playing his philosophy, and by the sounds of it, he's going to walk away.
You can't do that, can you? Like, what, is that just stubbornness, or because people have been nasty to him? What's
He says that's not the case. You know, people have said, oh, you know, do you just dislike the criticism? And obviously he said no to that. And there's talk of a European club off on the table. But surely your chances of getting a big club come in for you in Europe are much better after you've just performed well at the World Cup. Now, yeah, sure, Australia may perform terribly at the World Cup. Perhaps that's what he's afraid of. But it seems very mysterious.
OK, well, that's Australia. They're through. New Zealand are out. They lost 2-0 in Peru. Quite a lot of controversy in this one, Kieran. Fireworks late at night outside the New Zealand hotel, laser pens in the New Zealand keeper's eyes as well.
Yeah, the Kiwis are not happy. So firstly, they arrived in Peru, their flight was delayed, then they arrived in their bus to the hotel, took double the time it normally takes. And then at 3 a.m. in the morning, they were sleeping ahead of a very important game for them, obviously, and there was a loud fireworks display. A journalist who was in the hotel compared it to Guy Fawkes Night over in the UK. Then there was a military jet flyover later in the morning with the military jets painted with Vamos Peru, Go Peru. So, you know, the 11 New Zealanders on the pitch and the 50 Kiwi fans that had made the journey, they weren't too impressed when they stepped out onto the pitch.
How was the game itself?
New Zealand performed creditably. So it was a 2-0 win for Peru. Farfan and Ramos scoring those goals, and Peru were the better team and deserved their win. But you know, New Zealand didn't disgrace themselves either. I think they're just disappointed at the way it all went. And you know, they would have loved to have obviously gone back to the World Cup. You know, they're famous for that stat that they were the only team in South Africa 2010 to go undefeated.
It's something they don't like to talk about, though, so not many people are aware of that stat.
They've released a DVD about it, which we have talked about quite a lot. A word on their manager, Anthony Hudson, son of Alan Hudson, who's done a pretty good job, hasn't he?
Yeah, and he's done really well. You know, coaching in New Zealand, the New Zealand national team, is not easy. It's obviously not a major sport for them. The All Blacks, the rugby union team, is really the only game in town. New Zealand has a team in the Australian A-League, Wellington Phoenix. And they do okay. They've never really set the A-League alight. But from a core of Wellington Phoenix players and a few players that play in England and across Europe, you know, he's managed to guide them through Oceania, which, you know, Australia might have beaten American Samoa 31-0 back in the day. But it's actually a bit harder these days. The other Oceania teams are getting better, and the travel is sometimes not easy. But I think the Peruvian fans will be pretty stoked. This is their first World Cup since 1982. And the president of Peru has given them a public holiday.
That's exactly what you should do if your team qualifies. Listen, thanks for your time, Kieran. Kieran Pender there, cheers. Australian football writer. Few questions on this. Peter says, how smug should Max now be, having been proved right about New Zealand after the sticky took over his prediction? No, I'm not smug at all about this. I quite wanted New Zealand to get there. Paul says, does Peru letting off fireworks at 3 a.m. outside the New Zealand hotel fall into the category of, quote, things we don't want to see in the game, but really we do want to see in the game?
I think so, yes.
I've heard about the fireworks.
The military flypast
is next level. That's really taking it on a little bit.
And the bus going to the hotel via the scenic route.
Exactly. Yeah. There'll be a marching band as well there. I am not Mr. T on the subject that this will be the last comment on the DVD Undefeated that we've talked about a great deal. He says, New Zealand's decision to release a DVD called Undefeated after drawing all three matches in the 2010 World Cup is more understandable if you look at how difficult it was for them to find 22 professional players to fill that team. Midfielder Andy Barron had to take leave from his job at a bank to play in the tournament. Dave Mulligan had played for the Wellington Phoenix from 2008 to 2010, making 3 appearances. He was released during the 2010 season by the head coach, Ricky Herbert. Despite this, Mulligan was still selected to be part of the New Zealand squad by the head coach, the very same Ricky Herbert. Has there ever been another instance of a player being selected for a national team by the same coach who deemed him not good enough for his club side, especially by a country about to participate in a World Cup? Incidentally, Max, I have a copy of Undefeated, which I'd love to burn onto a DVD for you. Where can I send it? We will make that happen. I absolutely need to see this. Maybe we'll play the DVD at the live show, Baz. 14th of December at the Emmanuel Centre in London. Me, you, Barney, Jonathan Wilson, perhaps Sid, and perhaps a DVD of Undefeated. Jacob, you said you watched the England-Brazil game. How did you find it?
It was quite a dull game, and I think that was partly due to England's willingness to sit back, and also a little bit Brazil slightly had their foot off the pedal. They were pretty good in possession. They were after about 5 minutes, you realised that they were just going to keep the ball for a very, very, very long time, and England were really pressed back into their own third for much of the first half. That said, Brazil didn't really create many chances. First half, Joe Hart had, I'd say, probably one header from Gabriel Jesus to save, which was a half chance at best. Second half, he made a good save from a one-on-one from, I think it was Coutinho. And then later on, Fernandinho hit the post from quite a long way out. But it was kind of limited to that from that perspective. So England's back three of John Stones, Harry Maguire and Joe Gomez, who was impressive, gave a pretty good account of themselves against front three, which was Neymar, Jesus and Coutinho, with, you know, someone like Willian on the bench to come in as well. So yeah, they did well. Probably the bad point for England was, apart from keeping 2 clean sheets in a couple of days against the 2 best teams in the world, was they didn't really have much of a threat going forward. They didn't keep the ball very well. But then it was a bit of a weakened reserve side. I don't think Jake Livermore has done himself many favours. He's just not good enough for that level. And I think they're really going to have to get someone who can keep the ball a bit better, use it better, next to Eric Dyer in central midfield. That, for me at the moment, if you were picking the team tomorrow, that would probably be Harry Winks. Be interested to see where Adam Lallana fits into all of this, if he ever gets fit again. But they didn't have Dele Alli, they didn't have Raheem Sterling, they didn't have Harry Kane, who might have given Brazil's defence more to think about. But Brazil, there was one moment towards the end where deep cross from Ashley Young, who came on for his first appearance in 4 years for England, and straight away was making a goal-saving challenge from, it was Willian. So, yeah, he hadn't lost anything from his absence, clearly. He put in a late cross for Dominic Solanke, who had come on for his first England game after doing so well in the summer at youth level, and it came to him at the far post. He was completely unmarked, and just his touch was a bit heavy. And it wasn't the worst miss ever, but the keeper managed to block it out. But overall, I think they can be relatively pleased with, you know, respectable performances against Germany and Brazil. It's encouraging, at least for Southgate. But then, you know, the mood changes so often with England. It's a month since everybody was walking out of the Malta game in protest at how bad they were. So we could come to the March friendlies and they'll lose a couple and everybody will start piling in on them again.
You were saying before the pod, Paolo, that actually England have got quite a good set of players here.
Yeah, I think this is a genuinely talented England squad that is clearly not in the sort of top section of clubs going into this World Cup, but is in the section that has a chance to make a real impact at the World Cup, I think. I think that having Kane, I mean, Jacob just alluded to it, having Kane on the pitch makes such a huge difference, because I think even in a game like the Brazil game, yes, having a player who you believe, if we get half a sniff of a chance, might do something with it is huge for any team. But I think that we were talking about this just before we started. Having the core of Tottenham players together, a team that is performing so well, being able to use them as a unit, being able to use them when they're all present, which they haven't been in these games, being able to use them and rely on the dynamic that they have already from club level. I think that's such a huge and understated part of international football, because it is hard to make a real team, a cohesive team in limited training time. If you have players who know each other and can do that, it's just a huge advantage. And I think certainly from an Italian point of view, it's like a known thing that almost all of the most successful Italian teams have always been Italjuve. They've been teams that have had a big core of Juventus players in them at the same time. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to like about this England team.
Southgate's been I don't want to say that he's been brave in dropping certain players, because that's just what a manager should do. That's what he should be allowed to do. And maybe in the past, you know, you go back to the golden generation, there was too much celebrity in Sven Goran Eriksson, for one, McLaren. They didn't necessarily feel able to drop certain underperforming players, but then maybe they didn't feel they had the talent to actually come in and replace them. But Southgate, back in when he named the squad, he was quite, you know, outspoken on someone like Chris Smalling, who, centre-back for Manchester United, one of the best defenders in the Premier League, but he doesn't think that he's good enough on the ball, and instead brings in a lesser name like Harry Maguire, Joe Gomez, who he feels are going to suit the system that he wants to play. And England are probably going to have to make a couple of hard choices as well on how they fit in all their attackers, because if you're going to play the 3-4-3 that he seems to want to play, you're probably going to have to leave out one of Marcus Rashford, Dele Alli and Raheem Sterling. Previously, you might have thought, I'm just going to cram them all in and get them out of and play someone out of position, which is what Hodgson did at the last Euros when he stuck Rooney in midfield for no apparent reason.
No, the other thing, even just those names you listed, when you think about that, England having those options up front is something that has not been true in recent times. Like that is a very solid set of attackers to be going, oh, we're going to have to squeeze someone out of this group.
Yeah, and also, you know, Jamie Vardy. Yeah. And some of the younger players, Tammy Abraham, who's come in, and, you know, Slanky, you know, Sturridge can't get in there. We're
going to win the World Cup, Jacob, aren't we?
No, I think what you saw the other night is that they don't use the ball well enough. So they're really going to have to work out a way to get over that. And it's not going to be easy if it keeps coming back at them all the time. And just to think we can just play on the counter attack and use our pace, because I think other teams as good as Brazil and Germany and Spain and so on are going to be ready for the fact that a team might try to counter them.
Is Phil Jones good?
I have no idea.
Because Manchester United fans will tell you he's been the best of their defenders this season, as playing really, really well.
He is good, but John Stones is just, he is the real deal.
Okay.
You know.
But so next, but I mean, who would you, if it was your three, Jacob, would you play, who would you play? Maguire's done well in these two
Maguire's
games.
Maguire's done well, but He's unproven at that level, and he's still unproven at the highest level in the Premier League. You've still got Gary Cahill, who plays in that system for the champions, and is comfortable, and he wants to play, as we saw in Rome a couple of weeks ago. He wants to play on the left of the back three, so there's an obvious position for him there. Joe Gomez did himself you know, a lot of favours the other night as well. Jones, yeah, maybe. And can Smalling get back in? They've got options there. And Eric Dyer as well can play back there.
Yeah.
Could you
play a Winks and Loftus-Cheek, a sort of not very holdingy?
No, I don't think so. But I think you have to get that kind of protection in that system. But yeah, Loftus-Cheek, he didn't after his impressive performance against Germany. He was off after half an hour with an injury. Barney tweeted, "You'll never see him again." That's it.
He's done. Scotland have made an official approach from Michael O'Neill. He's contracted until after the next Euros. O'Neill, I think, has asked for permission to chat to them. Also, rumours of O'Neill going to to Sunderland. If you were Michael O'Neill, Barry, which would you do?
Well, funnily enough, I said a couple of months ago when Strachan resigned or got the bullet, whichever, that I was talking to a Scottish mate of mine, and I reckoned that if Northern Ireland didn't qualify, they would try and get O'Neill. I think he'd be a perfect fit for Scotland. If I was him, his stock is so high, I wouldn't touch the Sunderland job with a 40-foot pole if I was him, because it's a managerial graveyard slash death ship. He has so much credit in the bank, and he could lose it in a heartbeat.
Could lose it in Scotland? I mean, that's the risk of management.
I don't think so, but if I was him, I wouldn't touch the Sunderland job with a pole, because there are better jobs he could get. I should add, I would like him to get the Sunderland job.
Would you take it?
No, I've ruled myself out. I'm possibly the only football fan on the planet who's quite happy to concede that I would not be able to manage a team.
The Glendenning Wilson Sunderland dream team.
I'd be quite interested if Wilson got it. I think he could do a job.
Do you think so? But he, with his orthopaedic shoes on the touchline, he'd do a lot of standing up, wouldn't he?
Is there a role on the Wilson staff that you think you would be right for? You know, yeah. Wilson's, you know, the figurehead, and he's doing the tactics, but is there a role for
Sammy Lee clapping?
I could be good cop.
Yeah. Wales drew with Panama, 1-1. Some young players starting for them. Ben Woodburn, David Brooks, Ethan Ampadu. Ampadu's 17, born in the year 2000. He's from Devon. His dad played for Republic of Ireland under-21s. His mum's from Wales, so he could play for any of them. He could still play for England because that was a friendly, although Chris Coleman says he's fully committed to Wales. We don't know if Chris Coleman is fully committed to Wales yet, but we think he is. A word on Chris Gunter, who joined Gary Speed as Wales' most capped outfield player of all time, with 85. Wales have never had anyone get to 100. I think Neville Southall's on 92 caps. Germany drew 2-2 with France, scored a last-minute equaliser, so they're unbeaten in 21 matches. Lacazette scored twice for France, one beautifully set up by Martial. Romania 0, Holland 3. Ryan Babel's first goal for Holland since the 24th of May 2008. And Belgium beat Japan 1-0. And Lukaku's become Belgium's all-time record goalscorer, his 31st header in this game, not according to FIFA. They don't recognise three of his goals in a friendly against Luxembourg in 2014 because Mark Wilmot made seven subs instead of the allowed six, and FIFA nullified the game. Which is interesting, isn't it? Right, so the pots are out. Interestingly, in pot one, Russia, the hosts are always in pot one. This morning I'd forgotten, and I asked if this always happened, and someone on Twitter said, "You used to present a football show and you asked that stupid question." I'm glad he's kept up with my career. Russia and Poland in pot one. Poland fixing the rankings by never having friendlies and also being quite good, which means Spain are in pot two along with England. But Jacob, you don't think we can build a group of death?
Not in the traditional sense.
Okay.
I mean, I don't want to be sniffy about the smaller teams. I don't know enough about them at the moment, and I hope that they can really surprise. I say small, I mean, you know, some of the less fashionable names in there, but if anyone would like to tell me that, I don't know, Egypt or Japan, Nigeria could maybe form a group of death with your Spains and Brazils, then I'd be very happy to see that. But I just meant in the traditional sense of
when you look at a group and go,
what did you get? I mean, at the last World Cup, you got Holland, Spain, and Chile in the
good.
The same group, and Australia.
But with Spain in two, that, you know, as long as, you know, you could have Brazil and Spain in the same group, or Argentina and Spain. Aaron, not Adam, says, what's the most fun World Cup group England can get? He's going Germany, Iceland, and Australia. It would be quite fun. I mean, every game would be just laced with pain, and I'm already getting nervous about the whole thing.
Do you remember when they got Algeria, Slovenia, and USA? 2010. And the Sun's headline was easy. So England, Algeria, Slovenia, Yanks.
So can you make one up?
Yeah, Russia, Iceland, and Panama, which is RIP.
Okay, that's fine. That's good for you. Barry, do you like the pots?
I'm not against the pots. I am aware they are a necessity.
Yeah.
I have no strong feelings on the pots particularly. I would like to see England get Brazil, Senegal, and Japan or Australia for just a nice global spread.
So you could get Brazil, and Spain. Who's the best in pot three then? Sweden, Denmark?
See, I don't know enough about the African teams or Japan to know whether they're how good they are.
I mean, it's a similar spot because I didn't get to see that much of African qualifying. I mean, you look at Morocco, they came through the group with Ivory Coast and they didn't concede a single goal in qualifying. You know, that's an indication that they could be a tough team in pot four.
Anyway, look, you can all stare at the group and do what we're doing and do random guesswork until the draw, which I think is on the 1st of December. So you've got a couple of weeks to enjoy that, and then the real pain and analysis will begin. That'll do for part two and part three. The Premier League is back. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Only Jacob of the panel realised that this was part three. Barry and Paolo, you didn't spot the first break in the pod.
It's because we're having such a great time.
Oh, that's exactly right. Premier League's back. Jacob, you've written a lot about West Ham. You're a West Ham fan. David Moyes said, in a big article, so I'm being nasty and taking out one quote, "If it works, great. If it doesn't, I'll see the East End of London for 7 months and go elsewhere."
I mean, I wasn't in that. He was speaking to the Sunday newspapers at that point, so I'm going to assume that that hasn't come across as well in print as it probably did in person.
Yeah, I think we should be fair to him, but it looks great on paper, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, in that unveiling, he did his best to be positive because he was asked at one point, you know, someone really trying to set him up, and Barry will appreciate this, having spent a year with Moyes, is doom and gloom outlook at Sunderland. Straight away he was in there saying, we are basically going down. Someone said, are you in a relegation battle? And he said, no, this squad is too talented to go down. But then there were little lines there here and there where he said, you know, things will go wrong. And if you just take that out and strip that out, then you can really hammer him. And I don't know, that was one of those things where I assume that he said it as a joke to people. And then if you put it in a cold way in a newspaper where people are already kind of looking to have a dig at poor David Moyes for the last 4 years, then you can go to town on it.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you make, actually, because now you wonder, when people are being interviewed, are they thinking about the interview they're giving to whatever journalist they're talking to, or are they just thinking about the quote that then will go on Twitter and go on social media, and actually makes it quite difficult to say anything because things can get taken out of context, as I've just done.
It's a bit of both, because Moyes can't be unaware of the absolute roasting he got for his inaugural press conference as Sunderland manager, and was obviously determined not to make the same mistake again. And I think at press conferences, and with no little justification, managers and players are always wary of saying anything that can give the journalists an easy headline, that or something that can maybe be taken out of context. And I can see why they would be wary of that, because it regularly happens. So a lot of them just speak lots but say nothing.
Are you excited about David Moyes?
If I was to listen to only Sunderland fans, then no, because everything last week that I tweeted about David Moyes was met with a lot of, not towards me, but just negativity about David Moyes from Sunderland fans. He said about Sunderland that he shouldn't have taken it, that he said quite a lot about Sunderland, and none of it was complimentary. He said he made the wrong choice when he came back. When I tweeted that, Sunderland fans would immediately come back saying, hang on, we'd actually had finished the season quite well under Allardyce, and he inherited a defence with Kone, who was playing well, and he marginalised Kasri, who had done really well under Allardyce in midfield, and he had Jermaine Defoe, and he had Pickford, and so on. I guess the flip side of that is, look at Sunderland now. It's clearly a really difficult club at the moment to do well at. And then there are little moments where they would say that he's actually kind of a bit arrogant, and then I guess maybe you would latch on to the bit where he said, I think this is good for West Ham. And he said, David Moyes, speaking in third person, David Moyes is a good manager. It's a good gamble. If I was West Ham's chairman, I would be thinking about appointing David Moyes. And I'd see that as a good thing and everything. And you kind of think, okay, I can see maybe where they're coming from. But I think he has taken such a battering from the likes of us and supporters over the past, and probably his chairman as well, over the past 4 years, that he's really just trying to get it out there that he did have 11 good years at Everton that shouldn't necessarily go overlooked. And I think the signs are positive at the moment, from without playing a game, that people at the club have been, and around the training ground, have been pleasantly surprised by him at the moment, and the training, which was notoriously an issue under Slaven Bilic in lacking any kind of intensity has been different. And but it's still a move for West Ham, which shows the limitations of the club at the moment, because David Moyes, in an ideal world, after everything that's gone on, he wouldn't have got this job. They might have actually acted in the summer and sacked a manager who was clearly not good enough, and maybe hired someone like Marco Silva, who had shown himself to be pretty accomplished at Hull and is doing so at Watford and is now wanted by Everton as well. But they didn't do that, and now they end up with a manager who finished bottom of the league with Sunderland. You can't get away from that, and they've now hired, in their time, they've hired four managers at West Ham. Two of them have finished bottom in the previous season, the other being Avram Grant. So, you know, kind of it says something about the board at West Ham as well, beyond this, beyond what it said about Slaven Bilic. You have to ask a lot of questions of David Gold, Sullivan and Karen Brady.
Has anybody ever sounded good talking about themselves in the third person?
Barry Glendening has.
Okay.
Probably Zlatan.
Maybe Zlatan.
Pull it off. I don't know if Ronaldo does as well.
WWE wrestler The Rock, I think, made a career out of it.
Yeah. You mentioned Marco Silva. Yeah, he's wanted by, because you play Watford, West Ham. He's wanted by Everton. Watford have denied permission. Sam Allardyce has withdrawn his interest in becoming the Everton manager. What do Everton do now, Barry? Stick with David Unsworth?
Looks like they might have to stick with Unzi. I mean, I'm surprised they've got through the international break without appointing anyone, and I'm curious to know what happened with Sam Allardyce, that they obviously wanted him, but clearly not enough.
My understanding is that when Sam goes into a club, and correct me if I'm wrong, he gets rid of all the backroom staff, okay, and he brings all his own people in. And at Everton, because of the inverted commas fabric of the club, because of all the people that they've got there, you know, Duncan Ferguson, Unsworth himself, John Ebrill, I imagine a lot more, it'd be a very expensive thing to do, and it would sort of affect the issue. One of the issues that Koeman had, wasn't it, that he didn't have any link with all the academies and under-23s and all those kind of people.
It's probably just someone, but who's going to tell Duncan Ferguson he's out of a job? Not me.
Well, Sam could do it. That would be fun. They could televise that.
Silver, I'd be wary of taking that job, because I think Watford is so cleverly run by the Pozzos, and lower expectations there. I think he could actually, if they were to give a manager more than a season, then I think he could really do something there. Whereas Everton, I know they've got the money, but it's so much more expectation and pressure for him.
Yeah, I mean, and also if you're Marco Silva, at some point you have to stay in a job for quite a long time. Otherwise, you're just going through girlfriends very quickly. You're just jumping from one to another, aren't you? You just never stop and settle down, which is what Marco should do at some point.
You sound like his mum.
Everton play Palace on Saturday. 7 points between those two sides. Biggest game of the weekend, lunchtime kickoff on Saturday, is Arsenal-Spurs. Spurs have travelled a lot more in terms of international appearances. They should be more tired than Arsenal. Will that make any difference, Paolo?
Well, I think the defence is the sort of area where they've got some concerns. I know Hugo Lloris and I think Alderweireld are uncertain for this weekend. Vertonghen is supposed to play but is carrying a little bit of a knock. And Davinson Sanchez is, I think, the player who's travelled the most. He's travelled something crazy like 12,000 miles or something. So yes, on paper, there's some of that going on. I think that the way the two teams have played so far this season, you would certainly still, and also not just this season, but just frankly, how Tottenham under Pochettino have fared against Arsenal. It's six games now that they haven't lost to Arsenal. You know, they are, I think, fairly demonstrably at this point, a team going in a positive direction, whereas Arsenal maybe are not.
But you also have Tottenham's famously awful record away from home against, you know, top six opposition. What is it, 1-16? That seems to be a thing.
It's got a draw written all over it, hasn't it? Leicester play Man City. Frankie says, what do the pod make of Aguero's health? First, he was supposed to have cracked ribs following a taxi crash. Takes 6 weeks to heal a cracked rib. And until it does, the slightest movement is agony. Yet he was back in training in 2 weeks. Now he's fainted at half time. It just shouldn't happen to a super fit athlete who trains regularly.
I wouldn't like to speculate because I have no idea what his health is like. I would have assumed it was good, but, you know, who knows?
I can't comment on that. I have had cracked ribs, though, and that is true. Like, they're really not fun. Like, because You can't.
It hurts to breathe.
Everything hurts. Yeah. Like you can't lie down when you go to sleep without it hurting. You can't breathe without it hurting. You can't laugh without it hurting. Everything hurts. So it is rubbish.
And a sneeze football, is like being shot, isn't it?
Yeah.
What else is happening? Liverpool, Southampton. Nathaniel Clyne's had back surgery. Could be another 3 months out. Klopp went to hospital yesterday because he was feeling unwell. Says Mane, Henderson and Lallana could all be fit.
Well, Mane played against West Ham. Klopp said after that, before that game, that he thought he was ready for like 20 minutes, and then he started him out of nowhere after a hamstring injury for about 6 weeks. So, yeah, seems to be a fit guy. Liverpool hate this fixture, though.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, they never beat Southampton.
And that's they do sometimes. That's karma as well, isn't it?
You know, it's a bit like their Palace fixation as well.
Southampton have kept a clean sheet in their last four matches against Liverpool in all competitions, says the internet.
Burnley play Swansea. Manchester United, Newcastle's the late kickoff on Saturday. Pogba and Zlatan could return. Mark says, let's wager on when Mourinho first starts to complain about United's unjustifiably hard and unfair holiday match day schedule. I'd say before the end of the month, earlier should they fail to win this weekend. Monday Night Football is Brighton v Stoke.
I think Newcastle would beat Manchester United.
Get away.
And I think there will be a massive Mourinho Benitez meltdown.
I don't think Benitez has ever won at, certainly his Liverpool, didn't ever win at Chelsea's Mourinho, I don't think. So this would be a first for him, I'm imagining.
Didn't they always lose 1-0?
Yeah, it was pretty much always 1-0.
Do you want feedback corner and some questions?
Okay.
David said, Max, you didn't even describe what happened with the bad refereeing decision at Northern Ireland. We talked for a long time about the handball, but I didn't actually say exactly what happened. And I understand his point. There are maybe people listening all around the world who didn't see that incident. But I suppose at some point we have to draw the line. Like, if the next time we bring up Maradona's handball in 1986, do we need to say, well, what happened? Steve Hodge knocked it in the air. Maradona runs up. Looked like he hit it, but actually punched it in the goal.
The fact that we call it Maradona's handball negates the need to explain what happened.
Okay, so is David right and I'm wrong on this Northern Ireland?
I think he is. We should have said what happened.
Okay.
But let's not. In case there's anyone out there who still doesn't know.
Peter says, would Barry still perform as well in the pod if he was forced to play out of position, brackets, in another's chair?
No, I feel weird.
Okay. Irish-Italian Pingu says, the New Zealand video of their World Cup exploits reminded me of when Charlton beat Arsenal 4-2, great chip by Klaus Jensen in the 2011-2012 season, and released a full-length VHS of the game. Obviously a great watch. What is the panel's favourite football-related VHS DVD of a past game? Or what game would they choose to be enshrined in a DVD? All I have to add is, in the Cambridge United goals video of 89-90 or 90-91, the commentator was a 13-year-old called Owen Nurse, whose voice broke halfway through the season. So suddenly, on the highlights of Wrexham away, his voice went from really high pitch to really deep. They were high production values for those videos. Anyone have anything to offer?
Well, I love the Coventry FA Cup win video because it just reminds me of a great time in my life when I was sharing a flat with two blokes. One of them, Coventry fan, who used to come home drunk, put on the cup final DVD, and it was just happy times. It was great fun.
Mastov writes, Barry asks whether any manager had mistakenly missed someone out of a squad. That's when I picked my England team and I forgot Raheem Sterling. He recalls a Bobby Robson story told by Brian Robson. The England squad were gathered at the airport for an away trip. The flight was called. So Bobby was frantically counting up the players, checking off everyone, when he began to become animated. Where's Reedy? Where's Reedy? He kept shouting. Brian had to step in and with a quiet, you've not selected him for this squad, gaffer. And Burley says Stuart Pearce famously did his first team sheet as a manager, only for his wife to point out he picked 11 players, but no goalkeeper. That'll do for today. Paolo, thanks.
Cheers.
Jacob, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Baz.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.